Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In the new book Money, the unauthorized biography, Felix Martin challenges our conventional perception of what money is and where it comes from, and shows us how this misunderstanding has profound implications for the world today. We've long thought money to have evolved from barter as a medium of exchange, followed by the invention of credit and of banks. Martin says it's a plausible story. The trouble is that it isn't true. Felix Martin has worked for the World Bank and for the European Stability Initiative think tank. He's currently a partner in the fixed income division at Lion Trust Asset Management, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much indeed for having me on.
Give us a sense of how you came to feel that there was a necessity to write a biography about money.
Well, the feeble answer, which I'm sure many listeners of yours will expect, is of course it was in part as a result of, you know, the recent financial crisis, which was a big shock for all of us, and particularly a big shock for economists. And I'm an economist by training. Economists, you know, didn't do a very good job in spotting the crisis coming. In fact, as Queen Elizabeth II, my own Queen of Great Britain, pointed out very famously at the end of 2008 to an assembled group of British academic economists, she said, you know, how come none of you saw this coming? You've got all these complicated models and so on. But actually, in my case, the roots of it go much further back, really back to the time when I started studying economics myself. And I think, like a lot of sort of normal people, I thought economics was all about money and banking and finance and this kind of stuff. And I remember being very surprised when I started studying the subject to discover that this wasn't the case. And in fact, most bizarrely, you know, we hardly learned anything about money and banking and finance. So that was kind of the origins of my fascination with the subject and the, you know, the lack of it in the discipline you'd expect to know most about it and research most about it.
As you point out, the story that we have been told, this conventional understanding, the story is a very plausible one. It's one that does make sense to most of us.
Yes, it is, and it has a very, very long pedigree. You know, it's the story that you find in Aristotle. And, you know, you can find it throughout the history of economic thought. It's in Adam Smith. It's in John Locke, the great English philosopher. And you find it in most sort of economic textbooks today. But as you say, the fact is, I mean, economics has long been prone, of course, to theorizing without relying on evidence. That's a trend I'm happy to say I think is reversing a bit, actually, recently. But the historians and anthropologists who've looked into these kinds of questions have always maintained, and the evidence has become stronger and stronger, that kind of story, you know, isn't true. Of course, obvious question that arises is, you know, how could people have had this kind of wrong idea about what money is and where it comes from? And part of the reason is to do with historical evidence and the real nature of money and finance, because, you know, money and finance really are just virtual things. They're just sets of ideas, as is actually usually quite obvious to people today. All you have to do is think about most of the money in circulation or most of the money that you have. It's really just a balance on an account at a bank. It doesn't have any physical existence. And of course, if you therefore want to go back and investigate money and finance throughout history, you're trying to investigate something where there isn't any physical evidence. And so it's very tempting and understandable to fixate upon the little physical evidence there is. For example, coinage, you know, which is something which lasts and, you know, you can dig up when you go on an archaeological expedition. And so for that reason, I think it's quite understandable that people have often focused on money as a thing, money as precious metal and so on, because that's what remains if you're trying to understand how finance worked in the past. The other aspects of it don't remain. One only has to think, in fact, what would happen today if there was some terrible, you know, nuclear war or whatever, and, you know, our civilization was wiped out, and the historians of the future tried to reconstruct our financial history from our notes and coins. Of course, it'd be absolutely absurd. They're such a tiny part of finance.
You make the point in the book that this history of money really revolves around two questions, two great questions. The first of it is what kind of rule should govern the creation of the credit that serves as money and whose interests that it should serve? And the second question is who determines the answer to that first point, which really goes to show, and I'm hoping you can speak a little bit to this, about the political nature of money.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think the moment one has jettisoned this idea that money is a thing, and the moment one, you know, sort of looks, as it were, down the other end of the telescope, and you think that actually it's the system of credit and clearing which things like coins and notes represent, it's that system of credit and clearing which is really the vital part, then these two crucial questions on which the whole of monetary history pivots come into focus. And as you say, they are, you know, what actually is a dollar? What does it mean? How much is it worth? This is the question of the monetary standard. And then who gets to decide the answer there? And the point about it is that there have been many answers to that question throughout history. You know, what is a dollar worth? And one answer, for example, would be the one that obtained when there was a gold standard. You know, a dollar just means a certain amount of gold. And as the value of gold fluctuates, so the value of the dollar fluctuates. Another answer is the one that's typically given today by modern central banks, which target inflation, and that's telling us that the value of a dollar, this abstract thing, can be defined in terms of a basket of consumer goods, or rather in the rate of change of value of that basket. So it's an arbitrary answer, in other words, to that question. That's the first sort of crucial step to realize. I mean, there is no answer that's correct, as there is in, for example, the natural sciences. The right answer is the one that suits the economy and suits the society at a given point in time. It's the one that allows the economy to be dynamic and allows the society to be fair. And then the second corollary question is, of course, well, you know, those are political questions. Once you start talking about what's fair, that's really a very political question. And so the crucial question at that point is, well, who gets to decide it? The ideal, I would suggest, is that you have democratic governance of that question, a democratic answer to that question. But again, throughout history, that's not always been the case. Sometimes people thought that kings, sovereigns, could give the answer to that question. Sometimes, for example, under a gold standard, or as Bitcoin would have it today, no one makes that decision. You make the decision and you throw away the key. You say we're going to fix to gold, and that's that.
One of the fascinating things about the book, you talk about how somebody puts their mark on something, but the real historical origins of modern money come to ancient Greece. And what you illustrate in the book is how relevant that is to today. That isn't something that is ancient. That is something that is a holdover.
Yes, I mean, I think it is one of the most fascinating things about looking back at the very early origins of money, at least in the Western world. You know, as far as we're not sure, exactly when money was invented in the East, in India and China and so on. It seems quite likely that actually it was invented separately, this social technology. But what's tremendously interesting about looking at the very early history of money in ancient Greece, which is the first Western monetized society that we know of, is that the era of their monetization happened to coincide with this tremendous flowering of Greek culture and literature. So we have an enormous amount of extremely high quality thought about what was going on. What we learn is that they appear to have realized very early on that not to allow your monetary standard to be adjustable according to a system of democratic governance, so those two answers to those two crucial questions, not to allow it to be like that could be very, very dangerous, because what it could do, for example, if you had a fixed standard like a gold standard, this might end up serving the interests of only one part of the community, the creditor part of the community, which in those days was the aristocratic class. And that, if taken to extremes, as debt accumulated over time in a monetary society, could become very destabilizing for society. It could end in a big debt crisis because one half of the population were effectively a slave to another. And so one of their great lessons, which they appear to have learned very early on, was the need for an adjustable standard, the need occasionally to declare debts as null and void, to restructure debts, or in today's terms, we would also say to have slightly higher inflation over time. That's what gets rid of debts over time. Not always, not at all times. You know, you can't allow all the rules of society to just collapse and anyone can do what they like. But they said, you know, you must have a release, a sort of release of the pressure that can build up over time in monetary society.
I thought that in looking at the overall issues regarding money, that there are so many theories. You write about John Locke's theory of money, what is wrong with that theory. I'm curious as to how you came across these various theories and to look at them and ultimately put them into a context.
Well, it's I'm sure ultimately it just comes down to my slightly odd education as an economist, because actually I started off many years ago, and as an undergraduate, I was a classicist, so I was studying Latin and Greek and philosophy and all this kind of stuff. And so when later on I converted to become an economist, which took me many, many more years at university, I'm afraid to say, I had to go and do all this stuff all over again, and then did my doctorate and so on, I think I came to it from a slightly different angle that a lot of people do these days. Most people who study economics these days come from a mathematical or an engineering or a physics background. There's good reason for that. You know, economics is a theoretical subject these days, and one has to have good math. But I think because I came from another sort of starting point, I was just, you know, by nature interested in the history of economic thought. And because economics is a social science, because it's not like the natural sciences, the history of economic thought, I think, is actually quite important because economies change and in a way that the natural world doesn't change. And so different theories are right at different points in time. So anyway, because of that, I became very interested in, you know, the history of the way that people had thought about money, this absolute core institution in our economies and societies. And I think it turns out to be very fruitful to look at, you know, the history of monetary thought and very sort of educational about our own circumstances today.
You advocate narrow banking as a way to bring about greater stability. Give us a sense of what that is and how it could keep the financial crisis somewhat at bay.
Yes, I think. I mean, I think everyone is aware of some of the deficiencies which developed in the banking system as it exists today, as a result of the financial crisis. I mean, the big deficiency was basically that the operators, you know, people who operate the banking sector, essentially were able to take all the upside when things went well in that sector, but when things went wrong in that sector, it was the taxpayer who picked up the bill. And the thing is that the banking system as it's currently constituted does have intrinsic risks. It operates what's called an intrinsic liquidity mismatch. The liabilities of commercial banks are short-term, for example, demand deposits, your or my demand deposits. We can take them out whenever we like. But the assets of the banking sector, the loans that are made, take an extreme example, a mortgage of some sort, are very long-term. They cannot be liquidated very quickly. And this is it's this mismatch of liquidity which is the essence of banking, but it's also the reason why these bailouts come to be needed. And the idea of narrow banking, which is certainly not my idea, I hasten to add, it's an idea that originates with the great American economist Fisher.
80 years ago.
Exactly. You know, it was simply that the essential function, the function of the banking sector that only the banking sector can do and which can't be done by, for example, mutual funds, is the payment system. This is very important, and it can't really be done in the capital markets. And that function you do want to provide some public support for, public subsidy for. And therefore, you want to try and limit banks to just that function, and so they would become so-called narrow banks. And the way one would do that is by trying to eliminate, so far as possible, this mismatch of liquidity and maturity between assets and liabilities. So in practice, it means that banks would be required to hold short-term and very safe, in other words, government liabilities on their asset side. They hold treasury bills and so on, and their liabilities would be demand deposits with which people could make payments. And then all the other things which today the banking sector does, the riskier things, the lending to risky projects, lending to long-term projects, let alone things like trading and dealing in securities, all of those things could be done by other parts of the financial system, capital markets, parts of the financial system, mutual funds and so on, which would not enjoy a government guarantee, government support. And the hope is that that would then much reduce the chance of an unwarranted bailout of the sort that we had to go through in the US and the UK in the course of the crisis of 2008.
So at this point, it seems that it's my duty to ask that question of, okay, are you optimistic that that can happen?
I have to say that I'm not terribly optimistic it's going to happen as a result of the current sort of regulatory efforts. I think that the current regulatory efforts are commendable, what's going on a national scale in the US and the UK, in Europe, and even internationally. I think, however, that there's something I have to say which has gone wrong in our whole approach to regulating the financial system, and this is another reason why I prefer that reform of narrow banking. The approach that's grown up over the whole of the last 30 years, really, to regulation has been to make it more and more complex, chasing the more and more complex financial system and all the financial instruments in that system themselves. And I think that is, it's a bit of a rabbit hole that we're going down there, and that instead what we need to do is, instead of trying to supervise more persistently what people are doing in the financial sector, we should try and fix the structure of the sector in such a way that we don't have to supervise in such immense detail every little thing which happens in the financial sector. And that's why I think it's a sort of structural reform, like the introduction of narrow banking, and then trying to say, look, anything outside the narrow banking, you can pretty much do what you like, but if it goes wrong, you're on your own. I think has to be the way to go, only because it's only by making things much simpler like that we're going to be effective.
Well, the name of the book is Money, the Unauthorized Biography. It is published by Knopf. Felix Martin, thank you so much for sharing with us. I do appreciate your expertise.
Thank you very much indeed.
Again, the title of the book is Money, the Unauthorized Biography. It is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.